With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. I'm going to take a moment this morning to brag a bit about my hometown, Tulare County, as this first little bit of news is exciting that Joey Orosa of Pixley, California, here in Tulare County, was presented the 81st Klossendorf Award. It's the highest recognition given to a dairy cattle showman in the United States during the 56th World Dairy Expo. Orosa is a fourth-generation dairyman who manages one of the nation's largest registered Holstein herds. The Klossendorf Award was developed to recognize those who exemplify a person with great character, sportsmanship, and dedication to dairy cattle shows. Congratulations, Joey. And to brag a little more, here's today's top story. Tulare County is the top ag producer in the nation. Tulare County is the number one ag producing county in the United States for the year 2022. And while Fresno County reported a record $8 billion haul for 2022, it didn't beat out Tulare County's $8.6 billion report. Both counties benefited from improved market prices and continue to corner the market in the top spots of the nation for ag production. If you add in Kern County at number 3, the Central Valley are a combined agricultural and economic powerhouse valued at $24.4 billion. Just to put that into perspective, those three California counties account for 44% of California's total ag production, with a value of $55.8 billion. In addition to being the top producing county, Tulare also is known for producing the most milk in the nation, even with a decline in the number of dairy cows milked, down by 30,000. It has 40 operational dairy digesters, which capture methane and convert those greenhouse gases into natural resources. The digesters have helped Tulare County reach 56% of their 2030 pollution reduction goal, with a net reduction of 592,131 metric tons of CO2 equivalent in 2021 alone. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Beginning next year, the California Air Resources Board will have some new requirements for trucks. Director of Regulatory and Environmental Affairs for Western United Dairies, Paul Souza, explained some of the expectations of the new clean truck check rule.
This one was recently adopted, and basically what it is, it's a smog check for trucks. We're familiar with smog check for our cars. This works in a very similar way to ensure that truck emission control systems operate as they are intended to. There is a smog check program. Currently, it's called the Periodic Smoke Inspection Program, or PSIP. This new program, the Clean Truck Check, is going to replace that. So PSIP is going away, and it's going to be just the Clean Truck Check. The difference is that the Clean Truck Check is tied to DMV registration, where PSIP was not. So you're not going to be able to register your truck if you don't take the test and pass the test for Clean Truck Check. For newer trucks, what this involves is just plugging into the truck's onboard diagnostic port. It's not a regular, you know, something in the tailpipe. Older trucks will have measurements, but newer trucks, it's just, you know, you plug into the truck's computer, you get a readout, you send that readout to the Air Resources Board, and that's all you've got to do. The test does not have to be completed at a smog check station. It can be completed anywhere wirelessly by a certified technician using an ARB-approved device.
The Farm's Food Future Initiative, known as F3, serves as the nation's hub for agri-food technology for climate-smart agriculture after receiving the largest funding award in the country through the Build Back Better Regional Challenge. Executive Director of the Valley Institute for Sustainability, Technology, and Agriculture at UC Merced, Lee Bernacki, said that collaboration is a centerpiece to the success of the F3 initiative in accelerating the integration of technology and skills in the region's ag industry.
This program was designed to serve the ag community. There's so much knowledge and wisdom and awareness of what the challenges are, and we need you to tell us what's important to you to work on. And we need to engage with you directly, because we don't want to build more technology that doesn't go anywhere. We want to solve real on-the-ground problems. And it's meant to leverage the expertise we already have and help bring us to a better state, given all the challenges with water, labor, regulations, climate change. So please work with us and bring us your problems. And if you want to do some weird experiments, like, we are happy to come out to you, or you can work with one of our test beds.
To learn more about the initiative, you can visit f3.ucmerced.edu. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the USDA's Transition to Organic Partnership Program, or TOP, recently marked its first anniversary. It's an investment of up to $100 million over 5 years in cooperative agreements with nonprofit organizations that are partnering with others to provide technical assistance and support for transitioning and existing organic farmers. USDA Undersecretary Jenny Lester Moffitt says the program offers several benefits for growers.
USDA's Organic Transition Initiative launched a series of different programs comprehensively to support and expand organic production here in the United States. And so the Transition to Organic Partnership is part of that. Core to the program for the Transition to Organic Partnership is about building the capacity for farmers who are interested in becoming organic to be able to have the assistance needed to make that transition to organic farming practices. So that can be everything from technical assistance, field assistance, to transition different practices to organic practices. It can be mentorship, which is a really important part of this program, is a mentorship-mentee relationship. So you have someone to call when you need advice. And it also can be, of course, also access to resources that are available for organic producers.
She says the mentorship aspect is a vital part of the program because it gives growers the opportunity to have someone on their team who's already gone through these steps of going organic.
I think it can mean the difference between throwing in your towel and saying, I can't figure out the next step and you know, letting it lapse or pause or just, you know, giving up entirely, or being able to know how to navigate the next step with a mentor to call and to get resources and to ask questions. That can mean the difference of someone who gives up in frustration or someone who learns how to do it and then has access to new markets. And I think that's a really key part of this program, is the work that we're doing across USDA to build more new and better markets for producers to have opportunities for diverse market opportunities. And organic is a really important part about that. And I think that is a really key part.
She also says that those steps can be lengthy, and that's why the program is the length it is.
The land is currently farmed in conventional practices. That land needs 3 years to transition to organic production, and that can take time. And that's why it's really important, and as we set out and launched the Transition to Organic Partnership Program, that the program is a five-year program, so that transitioning farmers have the three-year support during the transition period. But then they're not left on, you know, on their own after they've become certified organic, that there's an additional year or two that they get additional support through this program as well.
The TOP program has set up partnerships in all 50 states and has reached more than 11,000 people.
So we announced the program last year, actually in the Watsonville area in California, with a roundtable of organic producers and also producers who are interested in being organic. So it's a year in, and key to the program is the partnership network that we formed. So there are six key regions around the country. There are leads for each of those regions in the country, but then within the regions, there are total over 180 partnerships nationwide. And these are organizations that farmers go to for resources, for access to information. And so that's a really important part about this, is that it is implemented locally and connecting, and it's at its core, it's about connecting existing organic stakeholders with those who are becoming interested in organic.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, U.S. Department of Agriculture did extend the application deadline for the Milk Loss Program, or MLP, to this coming Monday, October 30th. This is to allow more time for eligible dairy farmers to apply for the much-needed weather-related disaster recovery assistance. Administered by the Farm Service Agency, MLP, of course, compensates dairy producers who, because of qualifying weather events, dumped or removed milk without compensation from the commercial milk market in calendar years 2020, 2021, and 2022. Eligible causes of losses also include the consequences of those weather events. That includes power outages, impassable roads, and infrastructure losses. FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau said, "We recognize that MLP benefits are critical to the financial recovery of dairy operations significantly impacted by weather-related disasters that inhibited their ability to deliver or store milk in one or even multiple years. Many producers, of course, will have the required forms already on file, but those who are uncertain or want to confirm the status of the forms can contact FSA at your local USDA service center. But again, you have until October 30th to apply for this milk loss program." And representatives of the meat industry from around the globe gathered in the Netherlands last week for the World Meat Congress. With more about that event, here's U.S. Meat Export Federation's John Harreth.
The U.S. Meat Export Federation recently participated in the World Meat Congress in the Netherlands, a function of the International Meat Secretariat, or IMS. USMEF Vice President of Economic Analysis Erin Boer serves as co-chair of the IMS Economics Committee. She says it's important for the global meat industry to come together on common issues.
And that's really the value of the International Meat Secretariat, is joining together the global voice for meat and coming around common issues, opportunities, challenges. And I think in my mind, one of the most important roles is working with the global bodies. So the UN, FAO, the Codex, WOA, the World Organization for Animal Health, and having IMS as a collaborator and as a global voice for the meat industry is invaluable.
A major focus of the World Meat Congress is sustainability.
On things like animal welfare, on greenhouse gas emissions and how those are accounted for, those types of issues, as well as just the need for science-based standards on things like animal health. So again, the work with the World Organization for Animal Health, and same with Codex and the setting of standards for food safety. And so those are the areas where I think our collaboration has the most value. And as we think about things like the UN efforts on emissions and such, having the meat industry voice united from around the world and more outspoken has value.
For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harreth.
Thanks, John, and I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The pain at the pump is getting a little lighter. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. For the fourth consecutive week, the nation's average price of gasoline dropped, falling 11.3 cents from a week ago to $3.55 per gallon. The national average is down 29.9 cents from a month ago and 30.9 cents per gallon lower than a year ago. The national average diesel price fell 5.8 cents last week and stands at $4.48 per gallon, which is 55.2 cents lower than a year ago. Gas Buddy's Patrick DeHaan says, for now, the national average is likely to soon fall to its lowest level in 6 months. However, DeHaan cautions, this depends on actions that are not foreseeable, mainly the conflict in the Middle East. As the situation continues to unfold, markets will be watching interactions and responses between Iran and Israel. And while all eyes have been on those escalations, Saudi Arabia has put an end for now to a possible weapons and security pact between the U.S. and Israel. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Farmers that file Chapter 12 bankruptcy can deprioritize taxes on the sale of farm assets used in their farming business. But how broad is the provision? Chapter 12 bankruptcy is only for family farmers, and a big part of Chapter 12 is the ability to deprioritize taxes on the sale of assets used in farming. But that ability depends on your financial status and where you live. If you have sufficient assets to pay the tax in full from non-exempt assets, the deprioritization provision doesn't apply. Also, you have to satisfy the best interests of the creditors test or a liquidation analysis. That means you must provide the court with a listing of all of your assets so that a projection can be made for payment of priority and unsecured creditors. To make that determination, your available exemptions must be considered. So if the exemptions are relatively higher under state law, it's more likely that creditors will be paid in full and less will be available to pay unsecured creditors and deprioritize taxes. This all means that if you liquidate assets to make the farm viable and have sufficient non-exempt assets to pay taxes in full, you can't deprioritize taxes. It also means that farm bankruptcy is very technical, and a good farm bankruptcy lawyer that also understands tax is an absolute must. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullen.
The ag sector in recent years has faced several challenges regarding its workforce. USDA Farm Production and Conservation Deputy Undersecretary Gloria Montano Green provides a list of some of those, including:
how do ag employers support and create a safe and healthy work environment? How do we think about supporting employers and employees so they have a very stronger level of commitment to this positive work environment? The resiliency of our food supply chain, how we need to address ag labor challenges and instability, how we need to strengthen protections for farm workers, and how we need to expand legal pathways for labor migration.
That has led to USDA's latest effort to address some of these issues: a new pilot program called Farm Labor Stabilization and Protection.
So it is a couple departments or a couple areas within USDA that are working for it.
A joint venture between the Farm Service Agency and Agricultural Marketing Service in partnership with other federal agencies.
The Farm Labor Stabilization Program will allow us to provide opportunities for funding for ag employers to support their workers, domestic and immigrant as well. It will help accelerate that ag employer's efforts to have competitive employers of choice by improving the quality of the jobs they offer. And then for us, we'll be able to have an idea of the communities that are out there moving to be able to support.
These areas of priority through this pilot program include the addressing of current workforce needs in agriculture, reducing irregular labor migration through expansion of regular pathways, and improving working conditions for farm workers and ag laborers.
We know that there's a lot of things that producers are already doing. They're wanting to be able to have eligibility for funds to be able to make sure that they're able to implement some of these labor practices.
Up to $65 million in grants are available to domestic ag employers meeting federal employment criteria.
The maximum award is $2 million. The minimum award is $25,000 per grant, and you can have subawardees.
Grant applications are due November 28th. More details about the program are available online at www.ams.usda.gov/FLSP. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
stronger soybean demand here and support corn and wheat near term. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report at midweek, brought to you by Kloss Equipment, makers of the Kloss Treon 740 Combine. Learn more at Kloss.com. The September soybean crush we saw early this week, the highest ever for a September number, while demand for soybean oil pushing the month-ending stock supplies their lowest in 9 years. We do have slow exports, but this domestic demand can make up the difference in our view. January soybeans start the day near our resistance number at 1320. $5 December corn looks less likely now, with still half the crop in the fields to be harvested and slower barge traffic on major rivers. Cotton exports off to their lowest and slowest pace in 7 years. Futures look headed toward the bottom of what's been a three-month range. This is the Bottom Line Report. Looking at the livestock trade, U.S. beef production this quarter could see the largest increase in 20 years, but production will still end up lower than last year. Meanwhile, December lean hogs are testing contract lows from back in late May. That $68 level needs to hold today and this week. And that's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
The USDA's Transition to Organic Partnership Program, or TUP, recently marked its first anniversary. It's an investment of up to $100 million over 5 years in cooperative agreements with nonprofit organizations that are partnering with others to provide technical assistance and support for transitioning and existing organic farmers. USDA Undersecretary Jenny Lester Moffitt says the program offers several benefits for growers.
Technical assistance, field assistance to transition different practices to organic practices. It can be a mentorship.
She says the mentorship aspect is a vital part of the program because it gives growers the opportunity to have someone on their team who has already gone through the steps of going organic.
That can mean the difference of someone who gives up in frustration or someone who learns how to do it.
The TOP program has set up partnerships in all 50 states and has reached more than 11,000 people. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Peter Vitaliano, National Milk Producers Federation Vice President of Economic Policy and Market Research, says the hearing is making progress.
We're in the last topic of five topics. It is moving more slowly than expected because it did not finish in time for the original schedule. The facility was not available until 4.5 days the week after Thanksgiving, but it was not available beyond that. So there's another 5 days right afterwards and another facility not very far away. So there's 9.5 days with a chance that it will finish, but a chance that it may not. And that's all contingent upon government funding being available.
Vitaliano says the hearing was organized around the five proposals from NMPF.
But with other related proposals from other groups, and most notably by opposition in those same categories. There has been very strong opposition, primarily from the processing groups. That's the dynamic of the hearing. I know the Secretary of Agriculture asked for all the groups to get together, but the producer groups are together. That's the key thing. And producers are the ones who vote for federal orders. But the processor group is a very important constituency because they're the ones that the orders are imposed upon. And so they have a say. And USDA is listening, and they're going to come up with something that'll probably give something to all sides.
Vitaliano says getting to a vote is a lengthy process.
It's a quasi-judicial process where it is presided over by an administrative law judge. And it's formal courtroom procedure of witness testimony, cross-examination, objections, etc. The main difference is that an administrative law judge does not write the decision the way a criminal judge would. USDA and its marketing specialists are the ones who write the decisions. And we're expecting, if the hearing does indeed conclude the end of that the first week in December, the process then goes through a number of steps. And a vote that would actually implement the orders would be taken toward the end of 2024.
While the process takes time, Vitaliano says the modernization is needed.
The orders were really designed to operate most effectively when most of the milk that was covered in an order went to the fluid use. The orders are still relevant today, but technically, with less and less of the milk in a given order going to fluid, structurally, it makes the orders more difficult to operate. So when it's done, there's going to be probably some decisions and some issues that have to be examined. In the not too distant future, there are going to be some orders with low low class one utilizations. But this procedure is bringing the provisions of the orders up to date after being, in many cases, not updated in almost 23 years now. And it'll be 25 by the time the final decision is voted on.
Learn more and follow the process online at nmpf.org. Michael Clements reporting.
USDA's October crop production report again focuses on fall harvested crops. And as Lance Hodig of the National Agricultural Statistics Service explains, as harvest is underway, or in some cases completed, data is in part gathered from
our farmer reported survey, our ag yield survey, as we call it. We surveyed nearly 8,000 producers between September 29th and October 5th. Essentially, we were asking them to report what they either expect their yields to be, or as we get to this time of year, oftentimes they're reporting on actual harvest results.
Just one of the many data sets included in production forecast for crops like corn, soybeans, and cotton, such as
our objective yield survey. Rather than surveying farmers, this is where we actually send trained enumerators into fields, lay out plots, they take counts, measurements, ultimately we'll harvest portions of those plots, which is pretty prevalent this time of year, the harvest part.
The adjustments from the September crop production report trended downward. For this month, corn production forecasts are down less than 1% month over month. Soybean production is down 1% from the prior month, and cotton production forecasts were lowered 2% in October. Hodig says for all instances, yield reductions were behind the lower production forecast. For corn,
yield, we're now forecasting 173 bushels per acre. That's down just 0.5% or 0.8 of a bushel from what we forecast last month. So we're now actually looking at a yield that's 0.2% or 0.4 of a bushel below last year's final yield.
While for beans,
current yield forecast 49.6 bushels per acre. That is down 1% or just 0.5 bushel from last month's forecast.
And as for cotton yield projections,
we're now forecasting yield of 767 pounds per acre. That is down just 2.4% from last month, more than 19% below last season.
How did commodity markets initially respond to the adjustments in the October crop production reports? According to USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer,
I don't think it was the 0.8 of a bushel decline in corn yields down to 173 bushels an acre. I think it was the 0.5 bushel decline in soybeans that was perhaps a little larger than the trade had expected. And that brings us down to 49.6 bushels an acre.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have a podcast episode from the Vineyard team.
And with us today is Anthony Raimondo. He is an attorney and founder of the law firm of Raimondo & Miller in Fresno, California. And we're going to talk about some legal and regulatory things that are affecting growers all over the nation and the West Coast and multiple states. Thanks for being here, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
You've been interviewed and have written and have appeared widely and have had a number of interesting insights. And there are a couple of things that I picked up on from looking at one of your interviews that I really, for me, it spoke to me personally because I was in the vineyard side of things for a long time. And that's the issue of timekeeping. I'd love to talk a little bit about the kind of exposure, legal exposure that a grower might have around timekeeping, which on the surface sounds like a very simple thing, and in the field turns out not to be a very simple thing. And also what kind of practices a grower might get into trouble for, or what some ways growers can protect themselves. What kind of experience do you have on this topic?
It's something that we deal with quite a bit. We deal with both the compliance aspect of things, kind of that front end planning of how do we do things to stay out of trouble, but we also deal with the defense side of it. A lot of the litigation that's going on right now is class action or collective action litigation, where you have one or a couple of workers who stand in for the entire workforce over a period of years, alleging a range of different wage and hour type violations. And a lot of those things really come down to timekeeping.
Gotcha. Now, what we used to do back in the day was people would show up and the management would show up and we had a clipboard with an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper and we signed people in and checked them off. And then we basically looked at our watches and said, okay, we're starting at 9:05. And then everybody went out and worked. And then we checked what time we came back for lunch, etc. It seems like that would work perfectly well. But we did have some issues with folks along the lines that kind of disputed how accurate that was. Are those the kinds of things that get people kind of into trouble or kind of backward? Or what's the source of some of these complaints?
Well, those things have for a long time been in place and have for a long time have been an issue. And a lot of it comes down to accuracy. So when you have what we call a daily crew sheet, which is a very traditional way of keeping time out in the field, where, like you say, on a clipboard or something similar, we have a list of people's names. And, you know, maybe the upper right corner, we have a start time and a stop time, and everybody's name gets filled in on that list with the total number of hours and if there's piecework, what units they produced, et cetera. Well, way back in time, one of the very first lawsuits I dealt with in my career in agriculture was in a table grape operation where they had a similar method of timekeeping. But what they actually did is they would cut the bottom off of one of the grape boxes, and the foreman for the crew would flip that over and draw a grid on the back of it, write everybody's name on it, and would write the in and out times as well as grade information and the total hours for each worker. So everybody had the same in and out time because it was all being kept collectively. And in a deposition of one of those foremen, the plaintiff's attorney asked the foreman how he prepared these cardboard time records. And he said, well, you know, we come when the crew arrives, I get there a little bit before the crew and I draw the grid on the back. You know, I write the start time and I write the stop time. And it was a very big aha moment for the plaintiff's attorney because, of course, what she honed in on is that he's writing that start and stop time before any of those events happen.
Oh, right.
Because he's writing the start and stop time at the beginning of the day. What he's writing is the schedule of the crew, not the actual events that happen. We really need to have individualized time records, right? Because somebody always shows up late, somebody always leaves early. Having a crew of 10, 15, 20, 30 people where everybody has the same in and out time really isn't terribly reliable because it might generally be so that this is what happens. You know, they're a crew, they work together, they work the same. But as I mentioned, people show up late, people leave early, somebody gets sick, somebody gets hurt. These things all happen where those individual variations are what lend to the accuracy of it. And also those records being kept contemporaneously. And what we've seen over the years, and I've seen this accelerate in recent years, which I'm happy about, is the increasing use of technology as a solution. And I really think one of the most important things for growers to do is to embrace technology as a solution. And it's not just about the legal compliance aspect of things. Some of the timekeeping solutions they have out there are fantastically advanced now. So, you know, we can have foremen now keeping time on a tablet. We have, in some of the types of ag operations I deal with, we have harvesters who have individualized, it's almost like a name tag that they wear, where their in and out time can be kept individually. It's like an electronic pen they swipe that with to clock people in and clock people out. Their in and out times for their meal breaks recorded. We have devices where employees can clock in and out individually by cell phones, if they're smartphones. And by the way, a lot of those can be used for other types of risk management. A lot of the software that's out there now will ask the employee when they clock out at the end of the day, did you have any injuries today? Did you get your meal period today? Get your rest period today? And they can be programmed to answer a series of questions that deal with a lot of our risk management issues, not only related to things like wage and hour liability, but related to workplace safety, related to workers' compensation. This technology can have a multitude of different benefits. I have one client that I represent, and more are starting to do this sort of thing, who has even gone to using remote technology, what they really from like medical triage out in the field. So they have a telemedicine link set up with a monitor out in the field where if a worker is injured or reports some type of illness or injury, they can actually connect remotely to medical providers who can evaluate that injury very quickly. And a lot of times what they've done is they've reduced their workers' comp claims because they can deal with these small things, first aid incidents out in the field, which aren't reportable to workers' comp, rather than the treatment gets delayed, response gets delayed, and then something that could have been dealt with as a first aid incident in the moment now becomes a medical visit down the road, which just creates costs for everyone. So there's a lot of technology out we as an industry need to embrace.
That was just a portion of their conversation. Visit vineyardteam.org to listen to the whole episode. Stay tuned for more ag news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Western Growers and S2G Ventures have announced the three finalists that will take a chance at the winning prize for the 2023 AgSharks competition. This competition is a unique opportunity for startup companies to pitch their innovations in front of a live audience full of specialty crop producers for a chance to win a $250,000 minimum investment. The three finalists include Climate Robotics, Cultiva, and Provision. Climate Robotics is the developer of a mobile biochar production system for commercial agriculture. Cultiva is a global leader in plant cuticle health technology. And Provision is a company whose cloud software simplifies compliance for growers in any commodity, helping them meet requirements from customers, regulators, and certifications. The live pitch competition will take place at the Western Growers Annual Meeting November 12th through the 15th. The judges have also been selected for this year's competition. For more information, you can visit Western Growers' website. USDA Plant Health Safeguarding Specialist Kira McAllister discusses her involvement in the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services Pathways Program, as well as its various offerings en route to her current occupation.
I was able to start with my Pathways program within like Ag Discovery on my 10th grade year. I started with Ag Discovery, and from then I kind of had no clue how vast the opportunities within the agricultural field were. We had many different opportunities, from going to a cow ring show to visiting a chicken plant. It was just an opportunity that's once in a lifetime, to where not many students or people in general are able to see that side of the agricultural world. From then I went on to college at Florida A&M University, and I was able to join MANNERS, which is also a USDA pathway, which is Minorities in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Related Sciences. Within that program, I was part of the Animal Health and Care Academy, where I was able to pair with a mentor and get presentations from different companies within the animal health world, such as Merck, the USDA, just to gain different perspectives on the agricultural world.
For more information, you can visit usda.gov/youth/career.
The 42nd Annual Agribusiness Management Conference is coming up on November 8th in Fresno. Sponsored by Fresno State's Institute for Food and Agriculture, this year's conference will be held at Pardini's Banquets and Catering in Fresno, with breakfast beginning at 8. The morning keynote will be Senior Policy Analyst at S&P Global Commodity Insights, Roger Bernard. The first panel of the day will cover water policy impacts in the Central Valley, featuring speakers from the Public Policy Institute of California and Fresno State College of Social Science. The second panel will highlight ag technology and labor efficiency and include individuals from Burrow, Colterra Capital, and Farmit RX. The keynote luncheon will feature ag economist and consultant for Wells Fargo, Michael Swanson. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Plug and Play Topeka announced fall cohorts. 24 startup companies will begin a 3-month animal health and startup program this fall. Go Topeka is an economic development group, and they created the Plug and Play Topeka program, which focuses on connecting new ag tech startups with resources to help their companies grow. The startups, which hail from 10 different countries, represents a broad range of new innovations focused in areas like automation, soil health, pet nutrition, alternative protein, and sustainable packaging. Stephanie Moran, Senior Vice President of Innovation for GoTopeka, says, quote, "These startups are developing exciting new technologies and products across a variety of focus areas that will enhance the animal health and ag tech industries. We're excited to work with these startups and have the opportunity to showcase the regional resources and partnerships available to support the development and growth of their businesses while immersing them into our community." Of the 24, 13 are ag tech startups, and the other 11 are animal health startups. For more information, you can visit gotopeka.com. Grape growers will soon be able to purchase a crop insurance policy to protect their grapevines, not just their grapes. USDA's Gary Crawford talks with Marcia Bunger, the administrator of USDA's Risk Management Agency, in this report.
If you grow grapes commercially, you know that there are crop insurance policies that cover your grapes growing on the vine, but coming soon...
We have a grapevine policy.
Yes, a crop insurance program covering the grape vines themselves. This from Marcia Bunger. She runs the USDA's Risk Management Agency, and she told us...
They can insure all types of grapevines in a number of states, in select counties, California, Idaho, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Washington.
The policy, which will be offered in crop year 2024, will cover damage from everything, freezes to fires, floods, even failure of irrigation water supplies. How did I find out about this? Well, you knew that was coming, didn't you? Best way to find out about it is to go online, search RMA USDA, RMA USDA. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.